Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. AlphaList is a closed community with over 300 CTOs that share their knowledge and experience in a Slack space and at events. With this podcast, we want to give our members and interested parties insight into the thoughts and ideas of top CTOs. If you're interested in becoming a member of the community, please visit alphalist.com to find out more about how to apply. This episode is again kindly supported by Fastly, the key challenger in the CDN market. Fastly is pushing ahead the technical boundaries and is, from my perspective, the best solution on the market. Fastly is one of the key drivers of the edge cloud movement, meaning that you can execute parts of your workload on the edge cloud. In one of the next podcasts, I will also talk to Tyler McMullen, Fastly's CTO, about WebAssembly and the edge. Well-known customers of Fastly are Shopify, The New York Times, Reddit, GitHub, and many, many more. If you want to try it all with first-class support, just go to fastly.com/alphalist. Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I'm your host, Toby. Today, I have a very special guest from Estonia. His name is Sergey, and his company is called Pipedrive. So he's the CTO of Pipedrive. Pipedrive, for all of you who might not know it, is a growing software as a service company, basically a CRM company, I would say, that collected over 90 million in funding. And this episode will be around scaling and growing a SaaS company from the tech perspective. Sergey, maybe you want to introduce yourself a bit more.
Sure. Thanks, Tobias. I'm really happy to be on your podcast. So you called it right. Pipedrive is a CRM for salespeople. So it's mostly about helping people who do sales, not necessarily their managers or managers of their managers, which typical CRMs are kind of focusing on. And about myself, so I have been in the industry since 1996. This is when I got my first job as a developer. From the very beginning, I was involved in different software development related to internet. So it was kind of small insurance app on the internet. Then it was Internet Bank in 1998, which was a very progressive, very few banks actually had a possibility to do transactions on the internet. And after spending 8 years at the bank, I joined Skype in 2006. It was already acquired by eBay by that time, so I kind of joined Skype inside eBay. And I was mostly dealing with architecture of different projects. My main specialization was around billing because I came from bank, so I knew how to count money or how to do payments. With Skype, I was for 7 years, and I went through a couple of acquisitions. So eBay, as you may know, sold Skype to private equity fund, and then while preparing for an IPO, we were acquired by Microsoft, and then I spent 2 years in Microsoft. And I think a couple of like most interesting projects which I was involved in, one was video calling for Facebook. So we were actually powering the very first version of Facebook video calling. And right after the acquisition of Microsoft, I was dealing with developing Skype for the Windows 8 operating system, which wasn't ready yet to be released. And it was an interesting experience where you have to develop a software for the operating system, which is not ready yet. So it's kind of changing beneath you. You're like most of the developers are very used to So the fact that operating system doesn't change, like APIs doesn't change, and you don't have to reinstall your laptop every other week because there is a new version of operating system which is not compatible with the previous one. I spent 2 years in Microsoft after the acquisition, and then Pipedrive offered me a position of, initially it was VP of engineering. It was a small company, around 20 people altogether, 10 developers, but they just got the final seed round of 2.5 million, and the plan was for founders to move to California, but they wanted to have engineering leadership in Estonia, where I am located, and also wanted to start growing the engineering team. So that was my initial task.
Looking back at your history, then it sounds like a lot of different cultures involved in a very short time, like eBay, Microsoft, private equity. What are your biggest learnings from that time?
I think the biggest learning that it's very safe place to work in a big tech company. Like the crisis of 2008, for example, went completely unnoticed for us. Because we had our projects and we had our salary, and maybe the only notion was that okay, eBay stock is going down, but like who cares, right? And same happened with Microsoft. While being a part of private equity, we were definitely looking at expenses, and after acquisition of Microsoft, it was clear that we are in a much more stable environment, and we can just focus on a problem at hand, technical problem or like customer problem, really.
Was it always cool to work in such environments as a developer, or?
I guess it depends on the company, but I would say all of the companies where I worked, they were quite developer-centric. Like most of the technology companies are prizing their developers, right? Because this is where all the and the business is coming from. So if developers are not delivering or not celebrated as the biggest heroes, then usually there is no business for the company. So in that sense, it was cool. The scales are definitely different. Also, Microsoft, as I understand, the culture was kind of installed by the Steve Ballmer. So the Satya Nadella took over after I actually left, and I know that a lot of things has changed since. So if it was kind of very competitive between different divisions, then with Satya, it's actually more about cooperation, and cooperation kind of valued much more than the delivery of results, which at the end, actually, as we can see, have better results.
From my perspective, it's totally amazing how Microsoft changed from being like a totally anti-Linux company and a total anti-open source company towards a very open company that provides the best developer tools and the biggest developer community that is actually out there, right?
Yeah, when I was part of Microsoft, it really felt like it was a bubble where people inside of Microsoft had no clue what's happening outside of the Microsoft technologies, and they were not interested, right? And now it definitely has changed.
At Pipedrive, how is it there? Skipping a few years now, What do you do there, and why do you do it?
Well, now I actually have much more responsibilities than just engineering. So engineering itself is around 300 people. So it has always been almost half of the whole organization. So Pipedrive right now is 650 maybe. And then engineering is above 300. A couple of years ago, we agreed that I will be looking at the possibility to acquire some companies. And Well, first step was really just to define what is our acquisition strategy. What kind of software or features or functionality we should be acquiring versus building ourselves. And also, very important, which geographies we are looking at and what stage of a company we are looking at and so on. So I defined it and actually, interestingly, that right after just assuming the role and defining this strategy, we started getting leads. So with before that, there was like zero interest. And after we said, okay, we are not now going to look at possibilities, we started getting leads. And it was an interesting experience, which now resulted also in one acquisition, which we may talk later about, Mailigen, one Latvian company. But in addition to that, I now actually also responsible for customer support, sales, and customer success. Again, it's not I'm so super powerful. We just had a situation in the leadership where we haven't had anyone to take these areas under our responsibility, and we just divided them between executive members.
Okay, so you all have a lot of roles, or you're just taking the roles that nobody else wants to take?
It's not that nobody wants to take. We have been failing with hiring senior executives. Like we hired one, and then she left, and then we hired another, and he left, and then we decided, okay, let's not rush into hiring another one. Let's just like divide certain areas between exec team members and take it kind of slow and steady. So now we actually have a new CEO. It was announced just recently. So Timo Rein, who was the founder, one of the founders of Pipedrive, after 10 years at the company, he decided to give it over to a new person, and he himself is remaining as a chairman of a board.
I guess you have a vast experience in building SaaS companies then, also with like all the different roles and customer success and so on that you had or have. Let's imagine I'm a CTO or a product person that wants to build a successful SaaS company. What would be your top advice? What would be your do's and don'ts, like when I'm just getting started?
Yeah. If we are looking from the technology perspective, I think it's important to minimize amount of time you're kind of spending on building non-essential features or functions, because there are so many kind of services which are available to you, and you don't either for free or for small amount of money if you're not kind of at a huge scale. And instead of spending engineering time and resources building, I don't know, like user management or feature flag management or database scaling systems and so on, like you should really focus only on the customer needs. Solving them and validating if your solutions are actually kind of matching what customer needs. Usually, startups are not growing that crazy fast that you won't be able, like if you're wildly successful, like in Skype we used to say that scaling problems are good problems to have. Like the much worse problem is not to have anyone who would like to use your service, right? So I think the most of the focus should be put on validating the customer problem and the solution as well.
How would you measure that? So how do you measure the success of a feature at Pipedrive?
Well, feature adoption, obviously. So the customer feedback and is it actually used or not? And because Pipedrive is already became such a complicated software, like many of the features, like many of our customers don't even know about their existence. So then it comes to just how well you are able to educate, how well you are able to onboard customers, But also how well you are able to kind of simplify the feature for the user so they don't have to read manuals and spend a lot of amount of time to understand how to use this feature.
Let's make a quick test. So I actually know your software. My company uses it. I, for a hobby project, decided a while ago to switch to Airtable, which is, I guess, not really a competition because it's more like a database, because I was missing a feature and maybe it exists. So let's see if you're communicating it right.
What exactly?
Is it possible to easily build a custom scoring on behalf of certain customer criteria?
Highly requested feature. One of several which are our customers requesting. And I do understand. Let's say you want to calculate commissions, right? And commission is, I don't know, 10% of the deal value, right? So it would be so nice to have a field which just say commission, and commission value is deal value multiplied by 10%, right? So, but and we know about this problem. Again, it's just so many things to do in our software that this one specifically is not available, and there are workarounds, right? You can actually, because there is an API, you can kind of trigger an event saying that, okay, this field has been updated, and now do the calculation on a side of a pipe drive and then update this other field which you would like to contain this calculated
data. I was too lazy and too impatient back then because I just wanted to have something simple. I think for my company I would do it. But any other do's and don'ts you have?
I think very important to talk to the customers as much as possible. Maybe me myself is not very good at, but I mean we as a company, as PipeDrive, we have a separate research team who is dealing only with that, like talking to customers and trying to validate our hypothesis, what are the customer problems and how to solve them. So there are two phases, really. Just first validate that, yes, there is a problem and what the problem exactly is. And then once we have some ideas how to solve this problem and also validate that this solution is understandable, easy to understand, and it actually covers most of the problems. When hiring is probably one of the most important things, second to the kind of actually solving the actual problem, depending on what kind of people you will hire, your basically success will be determined. And initially, you need to hire generalists, I guess, people who are ready to take any kind of job and ready to quickly learn and as you are growing, like it's inevitable, you're going to have more specialized roles, and then you really need people who are kind of happy to go kind of narrow and deep in specific topic instead of being just wide in their knowledge.
Coming back to your validation approach, so do you do any let's say prototypes on features, or how do you do that? Do you invite customers, trusted customers, to features to test them? Do you do prototyping at all? How do you do that?
Yeah, we have. So initial prototyping is done just by the product manager and the designer. So they, and maybe some of the engineering leaders. So they sit together and brainstorm what kind of solutions would make sense. And then they validate the prototype. But then from the very beginning, we had a very extensive kind of feature flagging system, which allows us both enable specific features to specific customers, which helps you with gradual rollout of features, which also helps with continuous deployment and integration of the software. Like while you're developing, like the system, the feature is not ready, you put it under feature flag and you continuously deploy it into production. So basically, the software in the production have all the features which are being currently developed, but they're just not visible to all the users. They're visible to kind of developers and product managers.
Your example that you would rather license a feature flagging system instead of building it yourself, that is, I guess, something you did then as well, or?
No, I think when Pipedrive started, there were no available services like that. But nowadays there are, and instead of building this system, I would encourage people just to license a ready one.
Also, sometimes buy instead of make or rent instead of make is a recommendation you would give people?
I would say initially, yes. At some point, you see that at your scale, it does make sense to kind of build it internally. Or if you have very specific requirements which existing software doesn't cover, then it's also kind of reason to build. At Pipedrive, we actually do build a lot of also infrastructure components ourselves. And again, like for various reasons, but mostly it's just because there is no exact match and fit to what we need. And if we would give it up, then we would need to rewrite a lot of our components. So we choose to write some of the infrastructure components ourselves.
If you look at it today, what would you really say is your, then if you look at your product, what is your DNA? Is there a secret sauce you would focus on if you could like just focus today?
I think the software DNA was really to make it simple to use for salespeople so that they do understand, like so that the software matches their kind of thinking process. A lot of that to do with two of our founders who were kind of in the sales before Pipedrive. They were in sales for 15 years. We were consulting businesses how to do sales, how to organize sales processes. And software was built based on their experience. And I think they were just able to kind of simplify and generalize the concepts of successful selling sell processes. And this is why Pipedrive was such a successful business. I mean, we can build any kind of software, but if you don't understand the kind of user mentality, then you won't be successful.
I also remember when it was introduced at OMR, our company, it was something very new, unique and new to have like a very simple interface for sales, right? Back then, I think like the recommendation would be rather to use Salesforce, but that was simply not practical for smaller companies. I mean, today, I think it changed a bit. Like there's like a lot of competition in the field you entered, but I think you were one of the first companies that actually entered that field, right?
Yes, that's right. And I think from a business perspective, what Pipedrive is also unique about is very, very few companies were able to stay in this small company segment for such a long time. Like most of the companies, they start in the SMB segment, but then they quickly realize that enterprises actually bring much more money and they try to kind of go up market. But that usually fires back because in the up market, there are many more established companies kind of playing the game at much higher level. And for young companies, it's quite hard. And staying in SMB is also hard because the ARPU is not very high, but you need to, like, there are a lot of, like, if you keep your prices at a reasonable level and then you're successful, then your systems actually have to kind of scale with the business. And then it's becomes a question, are you able to scale both engineering organization and the architecture and so on.
I guess also, are you able to keep up with a very demanding enterprise market then? I guess like GDPR, data certification, pen testing at scale, that's something that big accounts might be demanding for, right?
It's demanding. It's interestingly that that the law, like GDPR, right? It's like for everyone. It doesn't actually even matter if you're serving enterprises or small businesses or just private people. Like you have to comply with the law. And for us, it was kind of a bit of a luck when even before the GDPR was kind of announced, we were in the process of scaling the system. I mean, every system have certain bottlenecks, right? So like your number of users grow and then some of the components start failing, and then you kind of spend some effort on scaling this component, and then you run into some other component not scaling well. And at some point, I had an idea that there is no point in chasing this bottleneck spree, but rather create an architecture where we can use so basically multiply the number of systems and then just spread the users across this multiple instances of Pipedrive. This way you can find a balance, like let's say with 20,000 customers, your system works well. With 30, it doesn't. Then you just split it in two, create two instances, and then just distribute the users between them. We called it multi-data center architecture. So the idea was that instead of just having just one data center, we have many in multiple geographic locations, and then we just distribute users based on their geography. And then it took us, I think, two and a half years to actually go from the idea to the kind of final moment where we started letting customers into the second data center, which apparently was in Germany, in Frankfurt. And by that, we automatically complied with many of the GDPR requirements. But it's definitely not enough. Like there are many more, and we have a separate team which is dealing with compliance with data privacy. It's not a very very huge team, but yeah, they are covering all the security and privacy aspects.
Do you then do stuff like penetration testing at large, or is that team also responsible for that?
Well, that team is responsible that all necessary things are done in terms of compliance and security. So there are many things you can do, right? So to understand what you need to do, we choose to look at certifications. Let's say there is a SOC 2 and ISO certifications, and you can read out what needs to be done, or what kind of processes you need to have, what kind of governance around different topics. So we choose it as a project plan. So we need to do this, and that. The certification just measures how well you're doing it. For cybersecurity, for example, we definitely use different defense and alerting and like monitoring systems inside. But we also spend a lot of effort on education of developers. And with education, you first need to kind of assess the knowledge of a group. And if you have a large group, and it's not only developers, I mean, the whole, like the employees, basically the people is the vector which is kind of used and abused most, because it's very easy to kind of protect the system, but it's very hard to protect insiders if insiders themselves don't understand what might happen. So there are like three type of people: the ones who are not interested and maybe not very knowledgeable. So for them, you just need to keep a bar. Right, you just need to understand who they are and then try to keep their bar at minimum so that they are protected. Then there is a group of people who are knowledgeable but not very kind of interested, not going very deep. And these are so-called blue team people. So they are good at defense, but they are maybe not very good at finding new vectors, right? And then there are people who are interested and also interested in going very deep in the topic. And these are the red team. So these people, you really kind of double down on educating them, and then you let them break your system, and they might be able to do it much better than the external parties, because they understand also internals of the system. And we also use HackerOne platform. We have kind of trusted set of external people who are really good. They know our application, they understand our business logic, and whenever we release kind of new features, we let them first know, and we paying bounties for them. So it's working for us really well.
Thanks a lot to our sponsor, the About You Cloud. The About You Cloud offers a full-stack e-commerce solution as a service that runs on exactly the same infrastructure as About You does. It is mobile-first, can act as headless system, event-driven, can be fully localized, and is super integratable into existing solutions. Besides that, it is designed and developed by a really smart guy, the CTO and friend of mine, Sebastian Betz, who also did the first AlphaList podcast with me. About You has set up a special task force for retailers and brands that want to be quick in the COVID situation. About You has set up a special task force for retailers and brands that want to be quick in the COVID situation. This task force will help you with the launch of your shop, as well as with fulfillment, marketing, support, and internationalization. Simply write to hello@aboutyou.com to be supported by this task force.
If I look at your software, so I actually yesterday did it. I looked at the network calls that are going out to your server. I see like a few different approaches, which smells a bit like you have some legacy. I guess that's also typical if you're in business with such a successful business. So how much do you have to fight with legacy?
Mm. Well, we don't fight with it, we embrace it. I mean, the project which I mentioned, this multi-DC project, actually also changed a lot in terms of like the application architecture itself. Like one key component to this architecture is the so-called we can call it API gateway, or so it's the layer which is doing user authentication, and then it's routing requests between different services. So like a lot of requests are going to the legacy system, but then like a lot of other requests are going to microservices, right? And whenever you kind of need to change or like, I mean, with creating a new features, it's very easy. You just create microservices and they are served side by side with the legacy system. And this routing system is allowing you to kind of proxy requests to a correct service. What we are doing also is just whenever we need to change the feature, like to add more functionality, we evaluate if it's worth actually extracting this feature from the legacy system and creating a microservice instead. What we also found out that there is a core kind of core object model, which is not possible really to extract like objects one by one. And there are multiple reasons. One reason is because the model itself is quite tightly coupled. Like there is a deal, there is a contact, there is a activity associated with one or the other. There are nodes. But then there are also vertical aspects of the application, like permissions, filters, and as long as these features are inside the legacy application, it's very hard to extract anything else. So in that sense, you first have to extract the vertical parts, like horizontal features And then you can start extracting the specific domain objects out of a legacy system. Yeah, so far we haven't done that. It's a lot of work, and my approach is like every project, engineer project, should also bring some customer value. If there is no customer value, then we don't do it.
Well, I mean, if you have the comfort that you can just deploy your application to, I don't know, 1,000 different instances and not necessarily even have data shared in all moments, then I think it's kind of a good thing, right? You don't need to have like that overarching bridge.
Yes. So again, like legacy systems, they grow out of like history, right? And again, that's maybe one other advice. If you start building like software from the beginning, don't try to build it scalable from the day one, because it's so much harder. You will be spending so much more time on this architecture and setup instead of just building the software. So I would argue that starting with monolith is completely perfect. And the only reason to start splitting it out into smaller independent services is not actually the scaling of the system. It's actually the scaling of a team. Because if you have like 10, 20, 50 developers, for them it's really hard to work on one component versus each of them having separate components. And also one of the, I call it basic right of a developer, is to be able to deploy your own code into production. And right now, because we have so many different, so we have like small microservices, right? And their deployment is fairly simple. But if you have a change in the big monolith, and 10 other guys having a change in big monolith, then there is a queue of deployments and you have to wait until all the other guys deploy their changes. So it's kind of artificially creating a bottleneck for changes inside monolith.
And you also have to be very careful with deployments, right? As things might break.
Well, things might break everywhere, but in that sense, yes, the bigger the component, the more central it is to the system, the more kind of the bigger impact will be on the customers.
Do you do any automated testing then? I guess yes.
Yes, yes.
Where does it start and where does it end?
Yes. The level of automated testing for different components is different. We were setting a bar to ourselves that for new, smaller components, like the at least 80% of code coverage happening, and we have components with 100% code coverage on automated testing. Unfortunately, that's not true for this one big legacy component, which has been started without automated tests. We added API tests, like integration tests on top later on, but it's not the same as having like 100% unit test coverage.
As far as I remember, I saw also GraphQL in your stack, correct?
GraphQL, again, it's one of the recent additions, and not all of the services have GraphQL. We created an infrastructure on top of existing API, which kind of we call it composite API, which and this infrastructure component is just serving the same REST API as GraphQL components.
So you're building some sort of the proxy layer, yeah, that is serving GraphQL, and that in the background serves a lot of other APIs?
Yes. So if instead of like having 10 different requests to the REST API, you just do one request to GraphQL, and then on the back end it combines all these different requests into one response.
Whenever you're talking about the big monolith, is there a chance for you to also rewrite that in total, or does that make no sense?
I don't think we will rewrite it in total. We had plans to on extracting different features, like, as I mentioned, filters. Like, we had a separate project for extracting filters from the monolith, and we had a separate project for extracting user permissions. And again, not for the sake of extracting it from the monolith, but for the sake of being able to apply this on other microservices, because right now they have to kind of handle this themselves. But wouldn't it be nice to have one common component which is handling all the permissions for all microservices? I think one interesting architectural challenge, like difference, we have, I haven't seen many of the companies which are doing that, is how we scale our database system. We use MySQL for like the main object model, and every customer is getting their own separate database. So when you do sign up, we create a new database, and you are using that, and that allowed us to any kind of queries, because these databases are very small, customers are small, and we virtually had no indexes on tables because there are very few data records, and you can basically join and combine tables as you want to. Obviously, for larger companies, this doesn't scale really well. So we are gradually kind of adding indexes and trying to optimize, and also looking for opportunities how we can scale horizontally one MySQL database. Like, there are certain technologies, but we just haven't picked one.
I think when I remember correctly, you also offer a feature where you index all the emails of a salesperson, right? I can imagine that this also somehow interferes with a growing MySQL database, or is that stored somewhere else?
So email metadata is stored in CoachDB. So we're using CoachDB extensively. And for indexing, like full text search, we use Elasticsearch. What's interesting is also that we use Elasticsearch also for our reporting services. Elastic aggregation functions were proved to be the fastest out of different technologies we were kind of exploring.
The Elk stack, like Elasticsearch, Logstash, Kibana, is kind of an amazing one, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's fast. Do you also use Kibana and the other tools there?
We don't use Kibana. So for logging, we use Graylog. So Elastic is used only for search feature and also the insights or reports. We use, for dashboarding, we use, I don't remember the technology, sorry, the name. There are so many names.
Yeah, and a lot of technology in your company, I guess.
Yeah, and a lot of developers and a lot of different needs. So another interesting technology we use is called Debezium. I don't know if you have heard about it. We had a problem. So whenever you change a data inside your database, you want to have the same change in different multiple databases. Like the one is search. Let's say you change the name of a contact and you want it to go into a main database, but you also want to go into Elastic so that you can later on find this person by the new name instead of the old one, right? And then Insights also have a separate database. And then we have this API events, or like webhook events, where on every data object change, our customers can get receive notifications. So we were sending those events from the application into the RabbitMQ. But the problem, as you can imagine, if this change later on, like, because there is no two-phase commit, if for some reason one of the transactions failed, then there is a lot of inconsistencies over time, right? And we wanted to keep data consistent, so we found this technology called Debezium, which is taking MySQL bean logs and sending them into Kafka queues. So basically, whoever is interested in the changes in the data flow, they can start listening to this Kafka queue events and then do their own appropriate changes.
Interesting. And that only applies to changes that really happened because it's in the business,
exactly.
Right?
And then because it's Kafka and you can keep a history of a change, you can also replay some of the changes if you, like, I don't know, process them incorrectly or something.
Yeah, sounds like a very special use case and a bit of a niche use case, but yeah, very interesting that you have a technology for it. If you look back at your company and also your culture, how do you scale in terms of teams, processes, and culture? Is there a special ingredient that you discovered throughout the years?
Yeah, actually, we did. So when we were growing, we were hiring new people. One of our philosophies was that we want each team to be able to run independently of each other. Again, this is coming maybe from my previous experiences where if you have too many dependencies between different projects, between different teams, then you spend so much effort on coordinating and planning. And I just wanted to avoid all of this waste of sitting in meetings and trying to wrap your head around when somebody is going to be ready and who can proceed and what happens if somebody is late and then everyone is kind of blaming this failing party and so on. So I wanted to avoid that, and I wanted every team to run independently. And that means that you're both organizational structure and your architecture have to support this type of kind of process. And it was fairly successful. So we grew up to, I think, around 20 small teams. So each team was around 7-8 developers. And there were good things about this, but there were also negative things. One negative thing was about legacy and history of a team. Like if you start a new team, very first project, they deliver really fast because they don't have anything to maintain, they don't have legacy. And the second one, because we also have a philosophy that you build it, you run it, so kind of DevOps mentality, the second project usually takes longer time because they still have to maintain the first one, and the third one takes even longer, and then at some point you realize that this team is not able to take anymore, and then you have to create a second, another team, right? which is not a problem per se, but for developers who have been with a team like for 2-3 years and they maybe want to do something new, it wasn't very easy to kind of move across the teams because there is always a negotiation. They are a critical part in their existing team and so on. So what we created is an interesting system where we call it missions and tribes. So the tribe is a bit bigger team, let's say 20, 25 engineers. And this team still own some of the system components. So basically we joined 3 or 4 teams into one bigger team, and they all inherited the components which they're responsible for. You get to certain efficiency. You don't need all these 20 people looking after existing components. So you can say that we need only 4 or 5 or 6 developers to look after existing components, and the rest can focus on building something new. And And building something new again means that if you're committing to building a new feature, a new component, you're kind of focusing on it, only on it. So you're there is an agreement that if you're an, we call it a mission. So essentially it's a project, but mission is a much better name. So there is a mission, and people who are on a mission, they're focusing only on a mission, on delivering a mission. And nobody is allowed to bother them with existing component questions or problems and so on. And those people who are not on a mission, they are working on existing components. Like if there is a bug, they're fixing a bug. If there is some request from, I don't know, general engineering to upgrade some versions, they deal with that. So there is a kind, and then people can rotate. Like the mission finishes, they land their new components, they exchange the knowledge, and then those people who were in maintenance mode, they can go on the next mission, and those who were on a mission, they can stay on, we call it launch pad. They can stay on launch pad and deal with maintenance.
Okay, and everyone wants to be on a mission always, right?
Not always, and people do feel responsibility, but and it also depends on the person and depends on his kind of state, personal state, because mission and they're exhausting in different ways. On a mission, you have a really clear focus, right? And while you're trying to hit the dates and then deliver results, you're still you don't have multitasking. And on the launch pad, there are a lot of small critical things to be done, and there is always constant switching. So people do say that launch pad is actually much more exhausting for them than working on a mission.
Sounds like a good concept. And as far as I understood, autonomy is a very big piece then in your idea of how developers are working ideally. How much autonomy in terms of selecting languages and baseline technology for each of the microservices, how much autonomy can one person have, or should one person have?
So people, like there is a supporting infrastructure. Like the way, like all the deployments are automated, and like testing is automated, building Docker images is automated, and for each technology, it's a bit different, right? And if you want, if you pick the technology which is already supported, then for you it's like easy. Like ready, steady, go. You just start writing, and there are templates for services and so on. If you want to pick a new technology, then like you have to create all of it before you deploy your first line of code. So there is a lot of.
But you're able to do it still, or?
I mean, if there is a good reason, then yes, we will support this decision, but if it's just because I like this technology more, it's like, but we are not ready to spend so much time on creating the infrastructure for what we like, right?
And maybe that goes into the same bucket. You mentioned at the beginning that you're also responsible for mergers and acquisitions, you actually acquired an Estonian company called Mailigen. I think it's an email automation platform, yeah. Right? How do you manage the technical and cultural side of the integration? Are they like fully working at your physical location, or?
So the company is actually Latvian, so they are very close to Estonia, but they're still like 300 kilometers from Tallinn. And the acquisition itself happened right before the COVID crisis. We had a plan to bring all Mailigen employees to Tallinn office for the onboarding. But because they're weak, they had to come to the office. Borders closed. Like we never were able to bring them to Tallinn for the proper onboarding. But nevertheless, we started the integration projects, and then we did that remote. We asked many of Pipedrive engineers to work on this integration project. So Meligen had, I think, 5 developers, and around 15 Pipedrive employees are actually now also working both on Meligen application and all the, on the integration project and so on. So there is quite significant amount of people helping Meligen to integrate with us.
Integration tech-wise then means that it's fully melted into your product, or?
So initially it will be just a synchronization of data between two applications and also some rebranding, redesigning of the Meligen software. But going forward, yes, we are planning to kind of make Meligen part of our user interface. Like there are steps there. Like first we need to make user management and billing the same platform, but then also the user interface will migrate. We also moving Pipedrive navigation from horizontal to vertical, and this is specifically to fit in Meligen, but also any other new kind of major blocks, because there's just not enough space on top of navigation bar right now.
Like maybe like a few closing questions, as we're already spent a lot of time, which I really like and really enjoyed. With your technical superpowers, if you would not crack the sales thing now, what big problem of the world you would like to solve right now?
It's kind of disappointing for me personally, and maybe now for you, is that I don't really know. I'm the kind of person which have to close the door before the next door kind of opens, and I don't know which the next door will be or should be. So I'm kind of don't think about it until the previous door has been closed.
So you're a focus,
yes,
loving person. And do you have like a tool or book you currently annoy anyone with because you recommend it all of the time?
Oh, there are many books which I do recommend. For example, one of the books is called Extreme Ownership, written by two U.S. Navy SEALs. And it's just talking about taking ownership of a situation or a problem or whatever. Doesn't matter on which position you are. Basically, they're saying that everyone is responsible for what's happening around them, right? And it's again, there are many books which are talking about on this about the same topic, where you should go, you shouldn't go get into this kind of victim mentality where all this happened to me. It's like this happened for a reason, right? Or like this other guy failed, right? No, it's actually you failed noticing that this guy is failing. I really like this mentality of taking ownership of everything that's happening.
And as a closing question, Sergei, I have a question for you and also a present. So imagine this year is a time machine and it can bring us back in the late 90s when you were like just finished with studying and starting your first job. And you have the chance now to whisper something into young Sergei's ears back then. What would it be?
I saw this question in your notes, and then I was thinking, what would it be? Maybe I would advise myself to try to be more self-aware, because I started to deal with this topic of trying to understand myself and be conscious about what's happening around 30s. So, and I think this is what actually helps you to develop as a person and also as a professional and be able to help other people much more. So the earlier you start with kind of developing your self-awareness, the better.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Sergei, for your time. Hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you, Tobias. Thank you.
Thanks again to our sponsor, the About You Cloud. If you want to get supported by their task force, just write to hello@aboutyou.com. And thanks as well to Fastly, our other sponsor. If you want to get supported by them implementing the world's best CDN, just go to fastly.com/alphalist.